On the program today, Clinton's speeches and Trump's statistics from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Good to have you along, everybody. It's Monday, the 17th of October, which means we are, politically speaking, smack in the heart of October's prize territory. To that end, the transcripts of Hillary Clinton's expensive speeches to Goldman Sachs came out over the weekend. They came out, we should be clear here, from WikiLeaks, which means we can't independently verify them. But without denying their authenticity, the Clinton campaign has accused WikiLeaks of trying to undermine her candidacy with the support of the Russian government. There are no real smoking guns within those transcripts, but they do show some differences between Clinton circa 2013 and Clinton today on the trail. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace gets us going.
Some call it flip-flopping, others call it evolving. Either way, it's not a secret that Hillary Clinton has, let's just say, updated her views on economic issues.
If anyone was under the impression that Hillary Clinton was not a politician, they have been set straight.
Julia Azari is a poli-sci professor at Marquette University. She says when Clinton talked to Goldman Sachs in 2013, it's unsurprising that she sounded lukewarm about financial reforms.
She talks about Dodd-Frank being necessary for political reasons.
And she says it's a sign of the power of the Bernie Democrats that Clinton has since hardened her rhetoric, promising she'll veto anything that rolls back financial regulation. David Birdsell, a dean of public and international affairs at City University of New York, says Clinton's views on trade have similarly been updated.
Plainly, she has been a proponent of increased trade, of more trade agreements.
And that comes through in the transcripts. But during the campaign, she's emphasized her skepticism about these agreements and promised to ensure they're good for workers. So which positions would she actually take if she were president? Aaron O'Brien heads the political science department at UMass Boston.
You can't go back on those policy positions because she's weak. She's weak with Democrats on trade, and she's weak with Democrats who view her as too cozy with Wall Street.
O'Brien says if Clinton's elected, there will be re-election to think about.
Basic self-interest kicks in.
In other words, she's compromising to get votes now, and election 2020 is just around the corner. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
We released the latest version of the Marketplace Edison Research economic poll last week, and one of the questions this time around was how people feel about the reliability of government economic data. In all, a quarter of Americans completely distrust government numbers like the unemployment rate and consumer spending. You break it down by who respondents were likely to vote for, and it goes like this. 5% of Clinton voters distrust government economic data. 48% of Trump voters do. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the rest of that story.
There are a lot of reasons why people distrust economic statistics. The figure that's gotten the most attention this election cycle being the unemployment numbers.
No, I don't believe them all the time, no.
No, I don't. No.
Danny Hollinger in Indiana, Donna Townsend in Nevada, Patricia Miner in Missouri. None of them put much stock in the official unemployment rate, which is currently at 5%. Now, if you ask people why, well, you do get some conspiracy theories about the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
The BLS is an independent agency. They're as professional as they come.
Jesse Rothstein is professor of economics at UC Berkeley.
It's completely crazy to think that they're being manipulated. The president doesn't find out the numbers until the evening before.
For the record, this is how the unemployment numbers are gathered.
So we have 60,000 households that we contact every single month, rotating households in and out of the survey on a monthly basis.
Mike Horrigan is Associate Commissioner in the Office of Employment and Unemployment Statistics at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They actually use about 1,500 data collectors at the Census Bureau to call people up on the phone or even visit them in person.
And from contacting those households, we get individual reports about labor market status from about 110,000 people every single month.
Some data is late in coming in, so the BLS has to revise its numbers later, which is fodder for conspiracy theorists who see thousands of data workers somehow forging numbers. But that kind of thinking isn't the only reason people distrust employment statistics. People actually have very non-crazy reasons for distrusting them.
Urington happens to be a very small town. There are no jobs. So my answer is no, I don't believe it.
There's no real good jobs for folks. No factories, no nothing for them to work in.
Donna Townsend in Yerington, Nevada, Patricia Miner in St. Louis, Missouri. Some people in areas where things aren't going well will look around and say, 5% unemployment? I don't see it.
I think people want the unemployment rate to capture more than it does.
UC Berkeley's Professor Jesse Rothstein.
I think there is a real sense in which the labor market has not been working for lots of people. But that's not coming through unemployment. That's coming through people aren't getting wage increases.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics does have other broader measures of unemployment. They add in people who have given up looking for a job. They add in people who are working part-time when they want to be working full-time.
The idea then is to take the official measure and then add more people in that numerator who are affected in various ways by what's going on in the labor market.
Mike Horrigan from the Bureau of Labor Statistics again there. The broadest measure of unemployment, it's called U6, is 9.7%. Higher than the official unemployment rate of 5%, but lower than it's been since 2008. At the end of the day, we measure the economy in numbers, but people measure their reality in feelings. And those are two things that don't always add up. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We've got our complete poll results at our website, marketplace.org. And while you're there, check out our Economic Anxiety Index and take our quiz, see how you compare with our survey results. Once again, marketplace.org. You can trust these figures or don't, but the major indices gave back some ground today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I ask you what Walmart's known for, you're probably going to say something about low, low prices, right? And that is true. The catch is that those low prices were made possible by pay for Walmart workers also being low, low. Economics being what it is, that bottom-tier pay structure brought some not-so-intended consequences sales-wise for the company. So a year and a half ago, Walmart promised to raise worker pay and make things better for those workers. Neil Irwin writes about how it's going for the biggest retailer in the country in the New York Times. He wrote about it over the weekend. Neil, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
We should preface this by saying that Walmart had not fallen on hard times, but they were not performing the way they used to, right?
Yeah, they had five straight quarters of same-store sales declining. They had all these reports of bad customer service, shelves that weren't stocked well. So they were having some real problems in terms of keeping goods on the shelves, keeping people coming into those stores.
And it seems like such an obvious idea. You pay people more and these problems will disappear. And that appears to be what has happened, but it's not without a whole bunch of backstory, right?
Yeah. You know, the truth is you get what you pay for in the labor market. If you're an employer and tries to lowball and pay as little as you possibly can, employees respond to that. And you only get the people who can't find a better job. When people do have the job, maybe they're not as dedicated. They don't work as hard. They're not worried if they were to lose the job. So there are all these effects that come into play when you're trying to do this strategy of keep labor costs as low as possible, pay people the bare possible minimum.
So Walmart and the CEO make a big splash of this. It's announced to the entire workforce and the world, better pay, regular schedules, this thing called efficiency wages, right? That's what economists like to call it.
Well, that's what I'm arguing this is a version of. So this idea from economists is that there is some reason if you're an employer to pay a little more than what the going rate is for a job. If you do that, you might get some benefits in return. Less turnover, more worker dedication. People are going to, you know, less likely to goof off when the boss isn't looking because they're afraid that if they lose that job, they're losing something valuable. Walmart, by going just not even that much higher in the grand scheme of things on wages, seems to have gotten a little more of these returns from workers in terms of dedication and willingness to really do their best.
But it is, you say, sort of a they're playing the long game because there's a little bit of a short run hiccup here, right? They're having to make this investment, sort of betting on the come.
Yeah, you know, one story that you hear, especially out of more labor activist circles, is, oh, if you raise wages, that will increase profitability. The data so far don't support that for Walmart. Their operating income is down for their U.S. stores where they've raised these wages. Their stock price has underperformed over the last couple of years since these announcements. Now, that doesn't mean it's the wrong thing for the long term. You know, if they want to have a long-term future and compete with Amazon and compete with all these competitors in every different direction, you know, they have to build a strong workforce and have good customer service and all of that. So if you think of this as a long-term investment, it might well pay off. But in the short run, this is something that's coming at a cost to profitability.
The great part of this piece was the bit toward the end where you basically say it's a Rashomon thing, right? Economists see what Walmart did one way. Labor activists see it another way. Wall Street analysts see it yet a third way.
Yeah, and it's all of these things. You know, the economy is better, the unemployment rate's lower, that creates upward pressure on wages. That's economic theory, and that's what's happening. This company had some customer service issues. They're helping solve those with these wage policies. You know, these efforts by labor unions and other activists to try and increase minimum wages around the country, create political pressure, that's paying off as well. All these things combined to create this decision by Walmart, you know, you know, the United States' biggest private employer, all these things combined to make them make this decision and pay their people a little better.
There is peril in generalizing from a single example, but Walmart is so big that, you know, maybe we want to go there. Explain how this might, stressing might, factor into the overall economic sluggishness that we've had in this country for the past 6-7 years.
Well, one thing we've seen over not just 6-7 years, but decades, is companies doing everything they can to reduce labor cost. And so what's happened is what's called the labor share of income has declined in the economy. Less of the national economic pie is going to compensation. It's going to worker salaries. We've also seen this perennial shortage of aggregate demand, this lack of demand in the economy that seems to be a factor in the slow growth we've been experiencing. There's an interesting possibility these two things are connected. You know, maybe what's happened is by cutting back on what workers are making, there's less of that growth in income that can be circulated through the economy and create the underlying driver of economic activity.
Neil Irwin is a senior economic correspondent at The Upshot at The New York Times. Neil, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
It's tempting to think our presidential election is an entirely domestic affair, but facts is facts. A big chunk of the rest of the world is watching, a chunk that includes hundreds of thousands of foreign students who might consider coming here for college. And here's the higher ed business proposition conundrum in that. American universities need those students more than ever. So the question is, after all the ugly rhetoric about immigration, are those students still going to want to come? From our education desk at WYPR Marketplace's Amy Scott reports on this election and international student recruiting.
Here's how important international students are to this country. There are almost 1 million of them enrolled in U.S. colleges, up from just over 500,000 10 years ago. They bring in an estimated $30 billion a year to the economy, and colleges say all students benefit from a multicultural campus.
We've become a very global economy, and universities want to provide that to their students.
That's Ben Waxman, CEO of International Education Advantage, which helps colleges market themselves to foreign students. Earlier this year, his company surveyed more than 40,000 prospective students from around the world.
60% of international students said they were less likely to study in the U.S. if Donald Trump is elected president.
About 4% said they'd be less likely to come here if Hillary Clinton wins. The survey didn't ask why, but Waxman suspects Trump's positions on immigration, like a proposed ban on Muslims entering the country and a wall on the Mexican border, had something to do with it. Mariami Dolashvili from Ukraine is already studying here as a junior at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She came on a scholarship, but had money been an issue, she says she might have done things differently were Trump in the White House.
If I would have to pay for myself and choose the country I want to go to, maybe I would choose some European country to go instead of coming here.
Rose Kunapalil, a graduate student from India, says whoever wins the election, a lot of damage has already been done.
When I talk to people back home in India, there are a section of people who are now second-guessing what the American people think about immigrants and of people coming to find their dreams here, you know?
Foreign students typically pay full tuition, so even a small dip could have a big impact. One example, new restrictions on a Saudi Arabian scholarship program has meant fewer Saudi students at many U.S. campuses. Mike Licari is provost at Indiana State University, where nearly half of international students are Saudi.
Enrollment matters, and small shifts in policy for domestic students or international students can, you know, shift those enrollment trends pretty quickly.
Saudi enrollment was down 4% this year at the school and is expected to drop again next year. To be clear, none of the candidates wants to limit the main visa program for foreign college students, but Trump has proposed cutting a program that brings exchange students here to study or work for short periods. Peggy Blumenthal is with the Institute of International Education, a research and advocacy group. She says anti-immigrant sentiment is worse in many other countries.
So I think that when students look around the world and look at other potential host countries, the U.S. still looks far more welcoming and far more accessible.
If that were to change, she says, colleges would work aggressively to keep the doors open. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, the current books out there were too difficult to understand, and what they really needed was something called DOS for Dummies.
And they got it. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 51 points today, 0.3%, 18,086. The NASDAQ down 14 points, 0.25%, 51.99. The S&P 500 off 6 points, 0.3%, 21.26. Bank of America traded up 0.3% today on news of higher profits in its bond trading business. Glad tidings didn't do much to help the rest of the banking sector, though. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley both dropped 0.9%. JPMorgan Chase fell about 0.5%. Twitter continued lower, spilling 0.9% on speculation about who, if anybody, might buy that social media company. The latest candidate is the Japanese telecom firm SoftBank. Facebook off 0.25% today. PepsiCo flat. Get it? PepsiCo flat. After it announced plans to cut the sugar content of many of its drinks, SuperValu charged up 5.75% today on news it plans to sell its Save-A-Lot chain to a private equity firm. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus fell to 1.76%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to take the show producer's prerogative here for our regular series, where usually it's you asking the questions and us giving the answers. I've always wondered is what we call it.
If you wonder.
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Today, given the tenor of the times, the question is, why are we hearing this in all those campaign ads?
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
Marketplace's Adam Allington explains exactly why approving a message became a thing.
Okay, raise your hand if you physically cringe every time you hear that ubiquitous phrase, I approve this message. You can't see, but I'm raising my hand. Well, there's a reason those disclaimers became a thing. Turns out politicians have been taking pot shots at each other since basically forever. Thomas Jefferson, for instance, accused his opponent, President John Adams, of having
hideous hermaphroditical character, which has neither the force and firmness of a man, nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman.
Now, Jefferson was careful not to say that himself, but his surrogates did. Fast forward to 1988 and another ad with accountability issues, the infamous Willie Horton TV ad. It was basically just a mugshot of a black man who was allowed out of prison as part of a weekend furlough program.
Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
As attacks go, this one was devastating for Michael Dukakis. And even though the ad was widely criticized as racist, the Bush campaign dodged responsibility, claiming to have no role in the ad's production. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden was also on the receiving end of anonymous attacks during his 1996 campaign for Senate.
I was just struck by the fact that you couldn't tell who was running ads.
He won that election, and when he got to D.C., he was determined to come up with a fix. He rallied up support for a bill which ultimately became the Stand By Your Ad provision.
Stand By Your Ad provides another reason why candidates will say to themselves, you know, that's something people can actually hold me personally responsible for.
The provision was later added to the McCain-Feingold Campaign Finance Reform Act of 2002. So, Stand By Your Ad becomes law, and people start hearing the disclaimers during the 2004 election. Problem solved, right?
Initially, it was true that we saw a change. It didn't last long.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson is the director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. She says campaigns quickly found new ways to obscure precisely who is approving what. One trick, just put the disclaimer up top.
So I'm Hillary Clinton or I'm Donald Trump and I approve this message. And then the attack proceeds from there. You lose track of the fact that the candidate was identified up front. And by the end, you're not paying a lot of attention to the print on the screen at the end.
And remember back in 2002 when Stand By Your Ad was passed, the internet was barely a thing, meaning today digital ads don't need the same approval disclaimer as TV or radio.
Posting something on your website or putting a video up on Tumblr or just uploading things to your YouTube channel, you're not required to do that at all.
And he should know. Joe Rospars is the CEO of Blue State Digital, the company that handled online advertising for both Obama campaigns.
We created thousands and thousands of pieces of video content and ran tens of millions of dollars worth of digital advertising that did not have that Barack Obama and I approved this message.
Attempts have been made recently to update the law. In 2014, Congressman David Price introduced the Stand By Every Ad Act, but it still hasn't been voted on. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
This is one of those series that, despite us coming up with our own questions from time to time, doesn't really work without you. Send us whatever it is you have always wondered about. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org.
As much as this election feels like it's dragged on forever, what I'm about to say is going to make you think, man, time does kind of fly, doesn't it? Next month is the 25th anniversary of the For Dummies books, those yellow and black books that are supposed to explain just about everything about this topic or that. Steve Hayes is the executive editor of the series. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Give me the origin story. How did it come to pass that we now, 25 years later, have these dummies books?
It's an interesting story, and it was a case where a couple of good things happened at the same time. Someone from IDG Books, the original publisher for Dummies, overheard someone in a bookstore saying the current books out there were too difficult to understand, and what they really needed was something called DOS for Dummies.
DOS is old-time computer speak for disk operating system, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And for which you needed some kind of guide, right? I mean, it was a mess, so you had to find it.
Very much so, yeah. Right. It was confusing, and people were getting computers for the first time and being expected to completely understand this,
right.
And no one was there to help them, and that's why the books were successful out of the gate. We kind of embraced that whole, you don't know this, we can help.
All right, so here's my question. 25 years later, there are still many, many questions about technology, but technology also provides the answers, man. Google.
Yes.
So what do you do as the publisher?
Well, I think we have to look to the future. We still have a very active and a very successful publishing program, but we're also trying to find ways to engage our audience in ways that they are going out and finding answers. So we have to look for ways to put dummies out there on YouTube. We have to look for ways to create courses that they can go take to maybe, you know, improve their job opportunities and so forth. And I think one advantage we have is because we have that 25 years of reputation as a good place to go for answers, when people find dummies in these new places, they may be more apt to look to us first rather than just someone out there putting up the answer off of a video they recorded on their cell phone.
I'm sure you get a zillion pitches every year. What makes for a good dummies book?
I think what makes for a good dummies book is a good author who understands their audience. Hmm. Our best authors are people who communicate with the individuals who are having issues. They are the people who understand how to explain things in a simple manner. And if they can put that into a book or into a video or into a course, then we have a successful dummies book.
What I imagine you have a shelf full of these books at your house or in your office somewhere, right?
Both places, yeah.
Which one is your most reached for volume? Which one do you go back to?
One is Golf for Dummies, written by Gary McCord, who's one of the CBS golf analysts. It's a hilarious book. And the best tip I got out of that was the best way to play golf and not get frustrated is don't keep score.
Yeah. Or don't play golf. But, you know, that's a whole different thing.
Well, that's the other option. But for some of us, we just have to get out there on the weekends.
Fair enough. Steve Hayes is the executive editor at John Wiley & Sons, responsible for the Dummies books, 25 years old in November, these books are.
That's correct.
Steve, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Kai. It's been an honor.
This final note on the way out today, which I'm obliged to preface by saying that I never have been a Bob Dylan fan. He just never did it for me. Don't hate me. But that said, I do think it's cool he won the Nobel Prize for Literature last week. And it's even cooler that, according to the Guardian newspaper over in the UK, the Nobel Committee can't track him down. They have emailed his friends. They've called. Nothing. I love that. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 51 points today, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 14 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 gave back 6 points, about 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Gurova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.